Was anyone in there with you?
He shook his head. Hilda felt along his arms and legs, and the man groaned. She cut her trouser leg away.
You've a badly broken ankle, I'm afraid. Does anything else hurt?
He shook his head again.
I'll splint your ankle, then we'll get you to a doctor. You'll be fine.
She administered a syrette of morphia, and in a minute the man's face relaxed. She worked fast, and soon had him ready to move. She marked a baggage tag with the letters T and M and tied it to the man's wrist. Hugh and Clive strapped the man into the stretcher, secured him on the roof of the Hillman, and jumped into the back. In the passenger seat, Hilda called out the turns while Mary drove to St. Bart's Hospital. They delivered the patient, and Mary drove the four of them back to St. Helen's Church. Down in the crypt, in the dim orange light from the bulbs, Hugh made them all tea. Hilda shook so badly that she couldn't hold hers. "The state of me," she said.
"You did a marvellous job. Was I all right? I hardly remember a thing. I had no idea a splint could be put on so thoroughly. In another minute you'd have bandaged him up to the eyes like Tutankhamun."
Hilda smiled.
"I didn't think we should hang around with the bombs. What were the T and the M for?"
"Oh, the tag is for the triage nurse. T is trauma, X is internal injury, M is morphia given. In training we practiced on the porters. They feigned injury and we tagged them. We invented codes too. We had D for dishy, P for possibly, and N for not if I was fat and this was the last man on earth."
Mary told the others she had to check something on the van. She sat in the cold with her knees drawn up and her back against the wall of the church. The raid droned on, the explosions sometimes close, and she hardly flinched any more. She thought about the X they had drawn on Tom. When she pictured his face, the X wouldn't leave it. It was even there in her memory of their walk on Hampstead Heath, when she had tried to get them lost in the mist. It was as if he had always been marked, as if he had known the ending. When she went back down into the crypt, someone had opened rum. From who knew where, one of the ARP girls had turned up some sugar. It was after 11 now, and cloud had rolled in from the estuary to blind the bombers to their targets. The crypt was filling up and becoming more convivial as the raid died away and the stretcher crews returned.
"To the Nazis," said Clive. "May their Reich indeed come third. May their gentlemen's nylons never ladder." "The Nazis," they all shouted. But Mary wouldn't join the toast.
When their mugs were empty, Clive filled them again. A dash of tea was added for the sake of decorum, in case the king should walk in. By 3 in the morning, the raid was as good as over. There was no more ack-ack fire, no more detonations, and just an occasional thin droning overhead as a last lost bomber sought its way home. In the crypt, the conversation had fallen to a murmur. People slept rolled up in their coats. The all-clear sounded at 4:30, and Hilda shivered with relief.
"Thank God! It wasn't as bad as I thought it might be. Are we still going to the party?"
said Mary. Hilda nodded and checked her makeup.
"Bloody Hitler! It's one thing to keep a girl up all night, but it's quite another to leave her looking it. Look on the bright side. You didn't kill a soul, and I didn't put a scratch on the van."
Clive was snoring in a corner, so they left him to it and went upstairs with Hugh. As they stood making their goodbyes, a flash lit the whole sky. The glare lingered in their eyes, and the sound of an explosion came, huge and heavy, followed by a crashing of falling debris that lasted for half a minute.
"Wonderful," said Hugh in the silence.
"What was it?"
said Mary.
"Delayed action bomb. Big one."
Hilda put her helmet back on.
"Mary, bring the van up front. I'll go downstairs and get the address when it comes in. Hugh, would you wake up Clive?"
Mary drove. The searchlights had all been extinguished, and there was only a dull, orange glow on the underside of the clouds, reflecting the fires in the east. The narrow slits of the headlights were not enough. Twice Mary almost crashed, pulling up hard a few feet from a wall, then reversing to make the turn she had missed. She felt disconnected from the reality of it. The war, the fires, the driving. One saw it all through slits. At Billiter Street, they understood straight away that it would be nothing like the first call-out. A crowd was pressing, in various states of dress, from pyjamas to duffel coats, with a policeman struggling to keep them to one side of the street. With the raid over, people had been making their way home from the public shelters, and now this. Mary used the horn and nosed the ambulance through the crowd. When they got to the centre of the damage, there were a dozen houses down in one terrace. The ones where the bomb had hit were simply gone, while those at the blast's extremity gaped open. The scene was 10 minutes old, and no one knew which houses had been occupied. People milled in the dark and yelled for their families. More police arrived and tried to push people back. An ARP patrol searched by torchlight in the shattered houses. A woman was struggling with the police, demanding to look for her son. She was hysterical, hitting out. Mary took her arm.
"We can look for him. Tell me where he is."
The woman pointed to the house. The front was gone, and inside Mary could see ARP men playing their torch beams over the interior walls. It was not a wallpaper she would have chosen. The missing boy's mother said that they had just got back from the shelter at the corner of the street, and that she had left her boy inside while she went to fetch a candle from a neighbour.
"Wait for us here," said Mary.
She went into the house with Hilda. They climbed over the pile of brick that had been the front wall. They found the ARP men picking through the front room and the kitchen at the back.
"Anyone?" said Mary.
The men shook their heads.
"Upstairs, then,"
she said to Hilda. They went up together. The banister was gone, fallen into the hallway below, and the stairs hung from the party wall they were keyed into. The staircase swayed, but it held. There was a stair runner up the middle of the treads, patterned with a broad stripe up the centre. At the head of the stairs was a bathroom, and by the flame of Mary's lighter they could see there was no one in it. The ceiling was down, the contents of the attic poking through the joists in a muddle of albums and suitcases. On the landing that ran back parallel with the stairs, there was a fecal smell in the air. A soil pipe must have cracked. The landing gave on to 2 bedrooms. Hilda took the first, and Mary the second. They trod as softly as they could, since the floor was unsupported at the street end, and the whole thing was bouncing nastily. She flicked on her lighter, looked for a moment, then snapped it off and knelt in the dark, forcing breath in and out of her body. In the snap of light she had seen a boy, lying still, his face grey, his body covered in shreds of blue flannel pyjamas and some foul-smelling mess that must have come from the broken wastepipe.
"Hilda," she said, "could you come as quick as you can?"
Outside the mother was still shouting, the fear in her voice more awful now the crowd was quietening down. Mary made sure that the place she was kneeling couldn't be seen from the street. She flicked her lighter back on and set it on an upended toy box.
"Oh,"
said Hilda when she came in. They knelt beside the boy's body. Hilda put her ear to his mouth.
"Anything?"
said Mary. Hilda shook her head. The mess was not from a broken pipe. The boy's insides were out.
"Oughtn't we to pump his chest?"
said Mary.
"How should I know?"
said Hilda in a small voice.
"It might make it worse."
"Worse how?"
Hilda knelt very still with her back straight.
"Come on, Hilda. What shall we do?" "I think it might be hopeless,"
said Hilda.
"But there must be something we can do. There must have been something in the training."
"I'm sorry," said Hilda, covering her face with her hands. The boy was brown-haired, slight, 8 or 9 years old. His eyes were open, and his grey face was fixed in an agony that was hard to look at. In his bedroom there were postcards on the wall, silhouettes of every aircraft type. On the chest of drawers was a trophy collection of the kind boys had. Fallen iron splinters, a brass shell case from a Bofors gun, a scrap of tortured aluminium that looked as if it might once have flown. The metal on its ridges had been polished to a shine by the boy's fingers. Outside, the mother, in a raw voice, was shouting,
"Mouse! Mouse!"
Mary stood, took her lighter, and left the room. Outside, on the warped landing, she fought back nausea. The stripe along the centre of the carpet was not a pattern after all. Even now, the stain was widening as the sisal took it up. Mary lit a cigarette. The boy had been downstairs when the bomb hit, and he had dragged himself up to his room and died.
"Hilda,"
she said. Hilda came, and Mary passed her the lit cigarette. Hilda couldn't hold it, so Mary held it to her lips while she drew on it and exhaled.
"What are we doing?" said Mary. "What are the two of us doing?"
Hilda hugged herself tight around the stomach.
"Don't. Remember after that first raid, when we took a cab to see the mess?"
"But everyone was doing it. It wasn't just..." Mary cut her off.
"Do you think we've seen enough now?"
"But it's different now. We're helping."
"Are we?"
said Mary.
"How many rooms are there in your flat?"
"Oh, I know what you're trying to do, but..."
"Isn't it awful? I've honestly never counted. 2 dozen rooms in my house, I should think, and 6 in your flat, and hardly a bomb has touched Pimlico. If we truly wanted to help, we could have hosted this whole street in your place and mine instead of digging through their rubble."
"We do what we can.
We visit by night and we fly west at dawn. We're ghouls, I'm afraid. We're monsters."
Hilda closed her eyes and let her head fall back against the wall.
"So what would you have us do?" "I don't know. We've never done anything, have we? We've no talent but conversation."
"Then go and talk to the policeman who's with the mother. Have her taken somewhere. Then bring Hugh and Clive, quickly, while I can still cope." Mary stared for a moment until understanding passed between them.
"Oh," she said.
When Mary came back with Hugh and Clive, Hilda had rolled the dead boy in the rug that he had bled on in his bedroom. They took up the runner on the stairs and the landing and made a second roll from that. They carried both rolls out on stretchers, each covered with the standard grey blanket, and secured them on the roof of the Hillman. At dawn, the sun rising through smoke, they delivered the boy to Moorgate. In fine cursive, Hilda wrote in the mortuary logbook that the child had died instantly and with no suffering, in a tidy and well-kept home. This was what the mother would read when she came for her son's body. They went to the party and got nastily drunk at opposite ends of the room. Hilda left with a flight lieutenant. Mary left with a spinning head and a certainty that she was not up to encountering her mother. She walked to a taxi rank and gave the address of the garret. She sat in the cab, with her cheek pressed against the window. She watched London, with its gapped teeth and blinded eyes. It got to her all at once, for the first time since the disaster. All the emptiness in the world drew her in, and she rolled her forehead on the glass. There was no sense to it. This was the unendurable thing. The war was 10 million severed and jangling nerves. It was all loose ends. Before, life had been a tradition, a tendency to forgiveness, a regression to the mean. The city she loved had been one of plane trees that had grown for 3 centuries, of bridges improved as horse gave way to steam, of great coordinated endeavours in which every convergent component could be relied upon, of symphonies. But now any light could be snuffed out without warning. When she had seen the dead boy, she had thought of Zachary. A child was lost as easily as a shilling. And once one had understood that, though one's heart continued to beat, one lived arm in arm with the lamented. She knew now why her father had not spoken of the last war, nor Alistair of this. It was hardly fair on the living. On reaching her destination, she was pale, and the taxi driver asked her, "Are you all right, my love?" And she smiled brightly and said, "Yes, thank you." When she let herself into the garret, it still smelled faintly of Tom. She switched on the electric heater, took off her shoes, and lay down on his bed. When she opened her eyes again, Tom had made her tea in one of his stock of jam jars that resisted all her attempts at improvement. She sat up to kiss him, since she did try hard to show him that everything was all right, and as she kissed him, she woke up, and it was noon. She washed her face in the corner basin, with cold water and a small grey fossil of soap. Everything remaining in the garret was Alistair's. She had boxed Tom's possessions weeks ago and sent them to his mother. When everything he had owned was packed and labelled, with Caesar in the last box and the tip of his tail just sticking out, Tom's things had filled 6 cardboard boxes, each 18 inches square by 9 inches deep. A man left 10 cubic feet. Mary went to Alistair's room, opened the wardrobe door, and stood looking at his empty clothes. She pressed his shirt to her face. She noticed a cuff that was beginning to fray, found a needle and thread, and sat down to mend it. She was not at all good at needlework. At home, the rule was that the maid did anything fiddlier than dealing cards, while Palmer lifted anything heavier than a gramophone arm. She forced herself to be patient, to keep her stitches small and neat. It was something to do. If she could bring little to the war, nor bear to side with her mother in avoiding the whole thing entirely, then at least she could fix these frayed edges. When the shirt was mended, Mary hung it back in Alistair's cupboard. And then, because she needed to live for the new hour at least, and because a pen and paper were available, she sat down at Alistair's rickety table and wrote to him again.
March 1941. For a whole month, the northwest wind blew cold and imperious. The siege drew taut around the island. The enemy's capital ships, black-hearted and lupine, circled just below the horizon where the coastal artillery could not reach them. Their warplanes wound white ropes of vapour around the blue dome of the sky, weaving the island a net to starve in. Alistair, alone, was happy.
"Alistair, I mended a shirt of yours, even though it is an awful shirt that ought properly to be torn into strips, plaited into rope, and used to hang your tailor. I have not mended a shirt for anyone before, so you must count yourself lucky. In any case, whether or not you wish me to proceed to the rest of your wardrobe, and perhaps you had better let me know, your dreadful blue shirt is mended. Affectionately, Mary."
Since Mary's letter had got through the blockade, Alistair had not minded at all about the millions of tons of material that hadn't. The island was without fuel oil, electric bulbs, aspirin, and margarine. His regiment was without new barrels for the artillery pieces. The magazines were down to 5 days' worth of shells at the present rate of usage. Islanders and soldiers alike were beginning to eat dogs, starting with the kind without collars. Alistair cared little. He roared with laughter when Simonson read out his own letters from his duplicitous girlfriends. The two captains aped the Knightsbridge voices together. The stews grew leaner, the meat giving way to bones that were used and reused until the marrow was gone and they leached more good than they gave. Alistair didn't mind. The bread became 1/8 sawdust, and then 3/16, and then 1/5. He took it with a shrug. He felt a solidarity with the wood-boring insects, and cheered his men by performing impressions of the bugs. Soon they were all eating insects, in any case. Alistair organised beetle hunts and commissioned an engraved trophy, the Cup of Plenty, for the man who collected the most bugs each day. Fruit could not be found at all. Men's teeth worked loose. The local children in their black church trousers, with their knees yellow from dust, began to have the restless eyes of card sharpers or poets. Alistair sneaked them crackers in his pockets.
"Mary, I do not know what you have against my shirt. It will be fashionable again. One must simply take the long view. It is inconvenient that I cannot rush home to London to thank you in person, but the oddest thing has happened. The Axis, who disapprove of sentimentality, have encircled Malta with the greatest concentration of warplanes and shipping ever seen, in order to prevent me from coming to see you. I expect they are doing the same sort of thing at your end. I suppose we must be flattered. Please do your worst with my wardrobe. In return, I shall make good such treasures as you may condemn to my care. As a conservator, I am trained to repair all kinds of damage invisibly. Expect me at around 5 past the end of the war. My shirt will have come into its own by then, I assure you. Warmly, Alistair." Alistair could not lose his smile, though the bombers were wicked and rapacious. Sometimes there was only an hour in each day for the civilians to swarm up from the shelters, to throw out the night soil, to queue for kerosene, and to take in the new ridges of rubble where the ageless streets had stood. Then the bombers came again, and everyone fled back underground. The surface became foreign, the underworld familiar. Sometimes Alistair was caught in a raid and had to go to ground with the islanders.
in the Neolithic burial chambers where the old bones had been pushed to one side, in the Roman catacombs, reconsecrated with miniatures of the Virgin, in the cold and dripping new tunnels gouged deep in the yellow rock, the fathers of the crammed-together families met his eyes while the walls shook. The children whimpered, and the mothers rocked them, and Alistair joined them to pray. Heart of Jesus, heart of Mary, make the bombs fall in the sea or in the fields.
Alistair, I cannot imagine what you are moaning about. A blockade by the enemy is nothing. Think of what I go through in Pimlico, entirely encircled by the inferior types of Chelsea and Belgravia. It is hell. There is opportunity here for your restorative talents, if you have the heart for it. You should report to me at your earliest convenience, in uniform, for heaven's sake, as you clearly cannot be trusted to dress yourself. Insightfully, Mary.
Whenever the airmail made it through, Alistair forgot the hunger. At all other times he was obsessed with it. One early morning he put the jar of Tom's blackberry jam into the bright slit of light from the arrow loop in his room. The aperture commanded a field of fire across the harbour approaches. Conversely, it drew in the full brightness of the rising sun and fired it through the jam jar. The colour rose with the sun from Venus to arterial, every tiny pip suspended in its matrix cast a black light of shadow. Sharpness flooded his mouth. How far had he carried this jar? How many different tents and barracks and forts had he shared with it? Once he had hoped to eat it with Tom at War's End. Now he hoped to take it to Tom's grave. Surely he wouldn't crack now. And yet his mind, unsolicited, came up with endless helpful reasons why it would be sensible to open the jar. These mornings were the hardest, just after waking, when one splashed the well water on one's face and drank a bitter yellow glass of it to fill the stomach. The water tasted of Malta itself, ancient and recessive, steeped in cordite and blood. The stone was porous, the hunger insatiable. Alistair put his hands to the jar and began to twist the lid. He stopped himself and picked up a pencil instead.
Mary, as usual, you are delusional. The uniform is far worse than the civilian wardrobe, even mine. This you would see if you were not blinded by the sheer glamour of this war. One sports a Sam Brown belt, which I am sure you would carry off better than I, and a cap with a polished leather peak. If it were not for the legitimizing effect of guns, enemy, etc., then the outfit would suggest nothing more nor less than the presence, within the psyche of the wearer, of perversion of the most florid stripe. Your handwriting conveys the same to me, by the way. Astutely. Alistair.
Today the battery was to rotate to Fort Benjema, away from the city, on an escarpment high on the Victoria lines in the northwest of the island. It was time. Alistair's men were broken and somnambulant. 3 of his 35 were dead, and 7 in Simonson's troop. The enemy's bombing had not lit up for 86 days and nights. Up in the hills, the regiment could regroup and re-equip. Perhaps, in the countryside, there would be a little more to eat. Alistair looked out to sea one last time. The northwesterly screamed through the signalling masts of the ships in Grand Harbour. The waves came in and in, as they always had. To the horizon clung a haze from the smokestacks of the encircling warships, corralling the island in time.
To Captain Alistair Heath, R.A. From Mary and North, Solicitors at Law, re Slander. Sir, we are commanded by our client, Miss Mary Anne Elizabeth North of London, SW1, to convey her intention to pursue you in law in the eventuality that you do not immediately and in full retract in writing your vile calumny, viz., that our client is delusional. Your comments, apposite to her handwriting, our client will allow to stand, but wishes us to communicate to you a fact of which your own various letters constitute proof abundant, viz., that our client's written submissions are qualitatively superior not only in calligraphy, but also in composition, to your own. Legally, Mary and North.
When Alistair looked up, he was surprised to find the war. She had done it again, her trick of making it all disappear.
He laced up his duffel bag, shouldered it, and put on his uniform cap as he stepped into the bleaching light of the fort's central quadrangle.
"Heath, there you are, you tardy bastard."
"Simonson," said Alistair, saluting with as much precision as it merited.
"Get in the truck, won't you? Anyone would think you didn't want to go on holiday."
Alistair climbed up into the passenger seat of the Bedford. Simonson started the big petrol engine and put it into gear straight away so as not to waste an iota of fuel. The men had gone ahead in a fleet of requisitioned charabangs and wagons, most of them horse-drawn, dispatched along the road at irregular intervals so as not to draw the enemy fighter aircraft that were now almost unopposed. Alistair and Simonson drove out over the main drawbridge. The quartermaster had issued them with a full load of artillery shells to take to the fort, and enough petrol, measured with a metal pipette to the nearest fluid ounce, to get them exactly to their destination, providing that they coasted down hills. Simonson piloted them through the ruins of Valletta. Alistair dropped the side window and enjoyed the warmth of the early morning. It was the right time of day to be making the trip out of the city. The sun wasn't too hot yet. The aces of the Luftwaffe were still on the ground in Sicily, signing photographs of themselves or doing whatever they did between bombing trips to a defenceless island. The two captains rolled through the winding canyons that had been cleared through the vast acres of rubble. Every building seemed to have been reduced to the infinite repetition of the same yellow stone block, 2 feet long, by one across, by one deep. It was the atom of civilization, the largest component that two men could lift between them. Simonson scowled through the dusty windshield.
"Looks like my alphabet blocks, after Randy found the castles I made."
"Heard from your dear brother lately?"
"Oh, he won't write. I'd be astonished if the bastard can even read."
"Hasn't he had his call-up yet?" Simonson fixed Alistair with a look of delighted condescension.
"Dear boy, they have to keep a few good men back. Otherwise we chaps might all get home from this jolly and demand the keys to the kingdom."
"Would that be so frightful?"
"You are a sluggish learner. Perhaps you are slightly retarded."
"I'm sure you used to be funny."
"Too many casualties of late, Alistair, that's all."
Alistair looked at him, and Simonson looked ahead at the road. It was the first time Simonson had used his first name. Alistair said, "I never thought you minded much about the men." Simonson cut the engine and coasted to a halt. He pulled the handbrake on and searched for his cigarettes in the pockets of his tunic.
"I didn't mind at first. When Dryden was killed, I thought, well, that's his lookout. And then Norris got it, such a terrible bloody aimer. And I was just glad it wasn't someone useful, like Carter."
Alistair nodded. "I'm sure Norris is a better shot now he's dead."
"Well, exactly. And in any case, I've never been fond of the men in the way you are. I hardly understand them, and I always suppose I had no more feeling for them than I do for cats. But then, the next week, Carter was killed after all, and I remember looking down at his body. We knew it was him by his wristwatch. His face wasn't where he left it, you see, and it made me furious. I don't know why that should be. It's not as if he was a handsome man in life. And yet I remember thinking, I would bury you myself. You know how hard it is to dig a grave on this island. 3 inches of soil and then solid rock. But I would have done it, if the men had let me. And then Vickers was killed, and Cullen, and Casey, and Urquhart. All in that one dreadful week, do you remember? And I've been desperately angry ever since. I actually loathe being an officer."
He exhaled smoke and pressed his thumbs to his eyes. Alistair patted his shoulder.
"It could be worse.
You could make major." Simonson took Alistair's arm and held it.
"All of this will stick to us. You'll see."
"After the war, you mean?"
"The men will loathe us, if any of the poor bastards are left."
"The men don't hate officers."
"It is the men's function to hate us. The fact that you don't understand it only shows your lack of breeding."
Alistair grinned. Simonson turned the ignition.
"My brother won't be called up, and England won't change. It was built with its blocks, the same as this damned island. When they reuse the rubble, you will see that it can only fit back together one way."
"I will bet you £5 that England is different after the war,"
Oh, spare us. Don't you think we should all be kinder to one another? I hope one's class will matter less, and one's convictions more. I hope we might be more inclined to pardon one another for our errors with both. I bet you £5 we shan't see war's end. That's not a bet I could ever collect on. See how it works? Said Simonson. He let out the clutch and steered the truck down the rubble-strewn road. They lurched on through the interlocking turrets and ramparts that marked the limit of the city. They were terrific fortifications and would prove their worth the next time the Ottoman Turks invaded. In the meantime, they would be useless against a German air assault. Perhaps Simonson was right that the regiment would not survive the siege. They were all turning to stone from hunger. They took cover behind stone walls. They painted their trucks and their helmets and their guns to resemble stone blocks, as if by sympathetic magic some hardness might accrue. They saw rubble walls when they closed their eyes at night. Sometimes, when one was particularly hungry, the omnipresent yellow limestone had the exact hue of cheddar, and when the enemy's paratroopers finally came, it would afford about as much protection. Alistair rested a notepad on the dash and dug out a stub of pencil.
2. Mary North, care of Mary and North. From Alice Taren Heath, solicitors at law. Re, a guided tour of the island of Malta. Madam, our client, Alistair Heath, Captain, R.A., commands us to convey to you...
Oh, for Christ's sake, said Simonson. You are like love-struck schoolchildren passing notes.
Alistair looked back at him mildly. So?
So, teacher says there's a war on.
It's just a bit of fun.
Well, it is sickening to be around. So you're in love, bully for you. You're not obliged to rub it in everyone's face.
Oh, come on, Simonson. You know I only have eyes for you. He looked over, but Simonson only stared ahead at the road. Alistair put the pad back in his pocket. At the city's edge, the fortifications gave way to a treeless plain of small fields, no larger than suburban gardens, enclosed as far as the horizon by a tracery of dry stone walls. It was arid land, with dry yellow grasses in tufts. Poor crops of oranges and artichokes struggled in the thin yellow soil. Dusty stands of barberry fig rose along the lines of the walls, and in the ditches teasels and reedy bamboo were footed in unseen damp. There were small rock escarpments, indistinguishable in hue from the walls, so that the eye lost the distinction between the man-made and the natural. One scarcely cared, in any case. It was wretched country, the kind no man would bother to wall in if any other land were available.
"Damn it," said Simonson. "I'm sorry."
"No, you're quite right.
You must write as and when you please. Don't mind my sour grapes."
"I wouldn't mind grapes of any kind. Who's fussy these days?"
Simonson smiled in a way that did not entirely release the tension. 4 109s barreled overhead in an asymmetric V, uncontested and exultant in the blue. Simonson swung the van off the road, and they jumped from the cab and threw themselves into the ditch. They lay with their hands over their heads for a minute while the aircraft noise diminished. The Germans had either not noticed them or not considered them worth the ammunition and flown on into the west. Simonson and Alistair climbed out of the ditch and sat in the shade of a yellow stone wall, dusting themselves off. Black bees droned in the thyme beside the road. Dogs barked from farm to farm. Birds gave monosyllabic cries, harsh and unlovely, as if describing the landscape. The wind worried up twists of dust from the road. Fat-tailed lizards ploughed the dirt, and from far away came the boom of the coastal batteries. Simonson looked out over the ruined country.
"You know who'd miss me if those planes had shot us up?" "No one."
Alistair shrugged.
"I might miss you."
Simonson seemed not to hear him.
"It would keep one going, to have someone who gave a damn."
"What about your 3 nice girlfriends?"
"If I died, they might wear the grief like a brooch for a while."
"I thought you were fond of those girls."
"The clue is in the plural, isn't it?"
"Then perhaps you ought to pick one."
"There's nothing to choose between them, don't you see? They spend their mornings in bed and their afternoons at Claridge's. They are indistinguishable among thousands. They're fireflies."
whereas you want the actual fire.
Must you mock me? You know me less well than you imagine.
I wasn't mocking. Well, only a little.
It's too easy for you.
Alistair held up his hands.
I'm sorry.
They remounted in silence and drove on, while Alistair drafted the letter to Mary in his head.
Commands us to convey to you his fulsome apologies for his libelous comments, which arose merely from our client's state of happy distraction brought about by the many utopian delights afforded by his present location.
Cresting a rise, they saw a pillar of smoke a mile ahead, thickening as they approached. Slow from the hunger, Alistair hardly noticed it.
The food and drink on this island are enough to render a man dizzy with delight. The foie gras has only one fault, which is its superabundance. The caviar is so consistently good that one gets a little weary of it.
The smoke was half a mile high now, directly ahead on their route.
There is a host of charming local rituals, many of them involving fire.
I think we had better pull over here, said Simonson.
Hmm?
It's just that we are carrying 3,000 pounds of artillery shells, and it seems prudent not to drive them through flames.
Simonson stopped the Bedford, a safe distance from the fire, and upwind of it. They got out to see what was going on. In a village of 200 or 300 houses, the church was ablaze. The wreckage of a bomber and the bodies of its crew were strewn around. Flames blew across the road, and the air stank of burning aviation spirit. People ran in and out of the church, bringing out artifacts to save.
Next, there are the art treasures, which the locals are quick to display.
It seemed the fire was burning itself out. The buildings were all of stone, of course. There was little wood to catch light. And now that the aviation fuel was burning off, there was only an angry soot being lifted in the shimmering, superheated air. In the little stone square before the church, a crowd was gathering. Alistair and Simonson pushed through it.
It is an alfresco culture, and one is never bored, as there is always something going on in the town square.
A German airman was on the ground, and the villagers had encircled him, kicking and spitting. A blade of bone protruded through one trouser leg. The side of his mouth was torn, the wall of the cheek hanging in a flap and revealing a row of bloodied molars. He was pleading with his tormentors in good English, accented only by his wounds.
"Damn it," said Simonson.
"The locals are hospitable to the British, though less well disposed to other foreign tourists."
Alistair shook his head savagely, forcing himself to concentrate on the present moment. His mind changed focus so sluggishly now, after the months of starvation. The enemy airman looked up at him, beseeching. Alistair felt a tightness in his throat. It was a scene he had come across during the long retreat through France. If an aviator had to bail out, it might be better to shoot himself on the way down than to parachute into the hands of people he had been bombing.
"Leave that man alone," Alistair's voice was lost in the din. "Leave him."
The people looked through him. Some grinned. It was a bad sign that there were no women or infants in the crowd. Evil made warning ripples. A boy of 11 or 12, in a clean white shirt, black trousers and a black cloth cap, laughing, kicked the German in the crotch. The airman drew into a fetal tuck, which caused his smashed leg bone to dig in the dirt. He screamed, and as he did so, another man kicked him.
"Please, I did not want to fight you. God save the king."
A man took a handful of dirt and tilted the airman's head back and packed the bloodied and protesting mouth. The man gave a choking moan. A purple mud of dust and blood escaped in clots through the rent in his cheek. There was laughter in the crowd, since the joke was now on the enemy. How pleasing it was that the whole great logistic of armies and states, of countless millions of fighting men and their associated materiel, could deliver a punchline to any grid coordinates at any time. The fire from the downed aircraft had spent all its fuel now. The haze caught at the back of the throat. More villagers closed in on the broken man.
"I'm a British army officer," Alistair shouted. "Leave that man alone."
He put himself between the German and the people, but they got the better of him. He took an elbow to the neck and another to the solar plexus, and he found himself winded at the back of the crowd. He could no longer see the German. Simonson took his arm.
"Come on, one mustn't expect more."
"You aren't serious."
They've been bombed for months. What would you have us do?
I'd like you to help me, said Alistair, taking his .38 from its holster and turning the cylinder to check the load.
For pity's sake! We have a ton and a half of HE in the truck, and the enemy is already airborne. You know how many men died to convey that ammunition? And you want us to leave it sitting in the open while you play white man's justice? The man is dying in any case. You saw him.
Yes, but I will shoot these people before I let them torment him.
Then I will leave you to it, Alistair, because I am not going to lose a truck full of shells for the sake of your pristine conscience.
The two officers stared at each other for a moment. Fine, said Alistair. He stepped around Simonson and cocked the hammer of his revolver. He fired 5 rounds into the air, and the jeering stopped. The locals spun around, startled at first, then with faces turning sullen.
It's quite all right, said Alistair. I might do the same in your shoes, but you may go to your homes now. I haven't seen your faces, and I shan't be taking names.
He stood with the Enfield pointed at the ground. He looked at his shoes. The wind piled dust up against his toes and scooped out hollows to the leeward. As he watched, he became aware of a slow movement in his periphery, a receding and a lightening. When he looked up, the square was empty, except for the squirming body of the airman. He holstered the revolver, buttoned it down, and knelt beside the man. The poor devil was face down and heaving as he tried to breathe through his smashed and bloody nose. As Alistair turned the head and began to scoop the dirt out of the mouth, he saw that the man's eyes had been put out. They didn't bleed. The sockets had been packed with yellow dust, like the mouth. The bloody foam hissed in and out of the man's nostrils as he fought for air. Alistair removed dirt until finally the man could breathe, in coughing gasps that sprayed blood. "I'm so sorry," Alistair said. He cradled the man's head. The black hair was sticky with blood, and the yellow dust had caked onto it. He was older than Alistair, in his late 30s, perhaps. An hour ago he had been flying, his tie neatly knotted.
"Look what they've done to you. I'm god-awfully sorry."
The man's jaws snapped tight around the side of Alistair's right hand, opposite the thumb. The splintered teeth, horribly sharp, sliced all the way through to the bone. Alistair yelled. He smashed his free hand against the man's jaw, but the teeth only bit down harder. Alistair twisted to change the angle, but agony gave the other man an awful strength. He dragged Alistair down to the ground.
"Stop it!" yelled Alistair. "Please! I'm helping you!"
But the man no longer knew what was happening to him. He took Alistair's throat, the thumbs pushing into the windpipe. With his free arm, Alistair tried to push him away. Sparks began to slide across the blue sky, which faded to indigo and to black. A shot came, and the thumbs released his throat. Alistair drew a long, rattling breath. The teeth loosened on his hand and released it. Alistair rolled away through the dust. As his breath came back, he managed to kneel. Simonson, who had shot the German through the side of the head, was still aiming the revolver. He wore an expression of distaste, and his lips moved silently for a while.
"Get up,"
Simonson said at last. After a long moment, it occurred to Alistair that Simonson meant him. He stood unsteadily. A near semicircle of flesh was missing from the side of his hand. Blood ran into the dust. Between him and Simonson, the German lay on his back with his arms laid neatly at his sides.
"Excuse me,"
said the German. Simonson and Alistair stared. Blood and yellow fluid drained through a hole in the man's temple and another hole in the opposite cheek.
"Excuse me,"
the man said again. Simonson shot him a second time, in the chest. Alistair supposed that some invariant politeness had caused him to wait until he was sure what the man had said. The German's body bucked twice, arching and relaxing. Then he drew a long, hissing breath and said,
"Sorry, I think you are speaking English?"
Simonson lowered his pistol and looked furiously at Alistair.
"I am confused," said the airman. "I have had maybe an accident. Excuse me for my English."
"Your English is fine," said Alistair.
"You are...
too kind.
Alistair knelt beside the dying man. I'm sorry.
Please let me go. Do not make me a prisoner. I have fear for my son. He is not a forceful boy, and I worry that he might... Excuse me.
The man fought for breath. Bloody foam leaked from his mouth. It's all right, said Alistair. It's quite all right.
If I am prisoner, he might at school be bullied and...
Simonson pushed Alistair out of the way and shot the German again, the bullet striking in the chest. The man's ruined mouth worked as he tried for another breath. Simonson shot him three times more in quick succession, the bullets destroying the abdomen. Blood and fluids welled through the dark flying jacket.
And,
said the man,
and...
I've no more rounds, said Simonson.
And the child is so... So?
Alistair took his revolver, aimed it quickly, and fired with his eyes almost closed. It was not a good shot, the bullet striking to the side of the man's forehead, lifting away a part of the scalp and exposing the skull, but not penetrating it. The force of it had knocked the head to one side. It was Alistair's last round too. The man took another breath, and another. Alistair dropped to his knees and did the only possible thing, taking two handfuls of the yellow dust and pressing them into the man's mouth. He still felt the hot breath hiss from the man's nostrils, so he pinched the nose closed and held the body down until it ceased to struggle. When it was over, Alistair stood. He and Simonson watched the man in silence, not at all sure he was dead. If the war had proved anything, it was that life had unexpected resistance to the instruments with which men had been issued. Simonson lit a cigarette.
I shan't forgive you for this.
No, said Alistair. I don't suppose I would.
We have to go. When we get to Bin Djemmah, we'll send a burial detail.
I'd sooner stay and bury him now. Simonson shook his head.
It wouldn't make either of you feel better.
The Maltese, who had watched the whole thing from their doorways, emerged into the street to give the two officers a slow, ironic handclap. The sound rang in the square while Simonson and Alistair walked to the truck. Between the yellow stone buildings, in front of the soot-blackened church, the cold northwesterly began its work of covering the dead man in dust. March 1941. Mary arrived at St. Helen's Church at 3:50, in premature twilight under smoke. The city smelled of brick dust and charcoal. The hush was already on it. People had gone down to the shelters early.
"Sleep well,"
said Hugh.
"Dreaming of you."
"Go on with you. The little one's out the back already."
Mary joined Hilda in the cab of the Hillman. In the yard behind the church, the wall was down, revealing the acres that used to be Bishopsgate. In drizzle, boys in shorts picked through the ruins for shrapnel and brass.
"Look at it all," said Hilda. "They say we shall win, but how? Father says the city will have to move underground if this goes on."
"I should hate that, shouldn't you?" "I suppose there will be ventilation shafts and skylights."
"Well, there's something to look forward to.
And are there to be murals down there, of woodland glades and seascapes?" "Look on the bright side," said Mary. "There might be..."
"There isn't a bright side underground. It's just dark."
"We must simply do our best, then, with tilly lamps and kumbaya."
"Lovely," said Hilda.
"But I might take my chances on the surface." "They won't let you. Even after we win, Father says preparedness will be the thing. Society will be organised, and people will live where they're told and do the jobs they're given, and be permanently ready to fight. Father said that was our mistake after the last war. We let people live willy-nilly."
"Yes, it was lovely."
"Father says it lasts about 20 years. After that,
Anyone half organised will do this sort of thing to us.
Mary cranked the wipers to clear drizzle from the windscreen, the better to indicate the rubble. Hilda said,
If that is really the future, then what is the point in living?
We could have hobbies.
One of my hobbies is tea. Shall we go to the crypt and drink some?
Don't you care about the future of civilization?
No, said Hilda. I care that Alistair still hasn't replied to my letter.
Oh, said Mary.
I can't stop thinking of him. Aren't you the slightest bit sympathetic?
Mary's heart caught.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it isn't your fault. Come on, let's go for that tea.
Soon the sirens howled up to their huge C-sharp and swooped down again to start their cycle. The first bombs fell, and the night was begun, and they were sent out to the first casualties. Clive was drunk before they even began. Hugh was white with fatigue. They picked up two deceased and were halfway through their first run to the mortuary when Mary took a corner and both the bodies on the roof flew into the street. Clive and Hugh had forgotten to strap the stretchers down. The men worked together to recover the first body, making a count of 1, 2, 3 lift, but they discovered, after two attempts and a long interval of confusion in the slits of the ambulance's headlights, that Clive had been lifting the arms of one corpse and Hugh the legs of the other. Mary watched them curse and begin again. As softly as she could, she said,
I've been writing to Alistair.
Hilda looked straight ahead and said nothing.
I'm sorry, said Mary, if that counts for anything.
You're sorry?
I waited for what I thought was a decent time. I wouldn't have written if I thought that you and he were hitting it off.
Hilda still looked straight ahead.
Who wrote first? You or him?
Mary rested her forehead on the wheel.
I don't blame you for being angry.
Angry isn't the word. You've done this since we were children.
I know. I'm sorry, Hilda.
In the useless headlights, the men got one body back onto its stretcher. They lifted it unevenly, and the corpse rolled off again. At every party you left with the nicest man, and whatever second-choice boy I kissed was closing his eyes and thinking of you.
Well, it won't happen again, I promise.
Oh, so Alistair's the last one you'll take from me?
I didn't want it to happen.
When did you know?
When I took his bag to the station.
So you did kiss him?
No.
Did you hold hands?
No, I was with Tom, remember? You don't know what it was like.
Why? Do you suppose I've never been in love? I feel these things, Mary. Hopeless as I am, I feel them. But you're always there, aren't you, to rescue me from love?
Mary closed her eyes. I'm sorry.
Hilda said nothing. A swing tune played at the edge of Mary's awareness, somewhere in the white noise, a phantom melody. Nobody slept. When the corpses were loaded again, Mary drove to the morgue. Now it took an age to get everything off the roof, since the men had made doubly sure with the strapping. Their cold hands struggled with the knots. With an effort, Mary kept her head from drifting down to the wheel again.
It's getting harder, said Hilda. What is?
To believe that this is endurable. Mary supposed she either meant their friendship or the bombing. Tens of thousands were dead now, and everyone left was sickened. This was something about war they did not warn one of, that death was an illness of the living, a cumulative poison. When Clive and Hugh had got the empty stretchers on the roof at last, Mary drove back to the church. They were all too weary to go down into the shelter. They listened to Tom's wind-up gramophone, which Mary kept in the ambulance now. Clive passed a bottle round. They worked at getting drunk enough to be able to do the job without being so drunk that they couldn't. Through the windscreen, in the orange glow of fires, the rubble stretched to the limit of sight.
It's all right for you, said Hilda. But I don't have anyone. You will. You'll see.
Listen to yourself, said Hilda. The sadness calcified. The ARP controller tapped on the ambulance window with a fresh address. Mary parked the gramophone's needle and drove. Hilda rested her head against the passenger window and watched the Akak gliding up. The incident was in Farringdon, past their usual patch, and when they got there the scene was already busy with ambulances and fire crews. An office building had come down on top of the shelter beneath it, and the wreckage was ablaze. The crews had worked an access route down into the shelter, and Clive and Hugh joined them to bring out the wounded. The firemen played hoses on the steaming rubble around the access tunnel, and the stretcher parties were coming out drenched. Hilda took her medical bag and went down without a word. After a minute, Mary couldn't bear it and went down after her. The tunnel began under a bowed steel lintel and tended steeply down a stairway that had been filled by rubble when the building collapsed. It had been excavated sufficiently to permit passage if one doubled over. Freezing water poured from the roof of the tunnel. The dim light from the flames outside surrendered to a darkness broken by battery lamps every few yards. Mary's knees scraped on the sharp rubble, and her tin hat slammed against the beam so hard that she was stunned for a moment. Shouts were coming up from the darkness. She forced herself to continue. The tunnel opened out into what Mary took to be a large water tank, in which for some reason the men of the rescue crews were wading thigh-deep by the bewildering light of torches.
"Where's the shelter?"
she asked a rescuer.
"This is it."
She must have looked blank, because he said,
"It's water from the fire hoses. Flooding."
The survivors seemed all to have been brought out. The people down here were rescuers, and Mary saw them going down into the black water, plunging in and staying under for long moments before surfacing with gasps. Hilda came back over to her. "They're only looking for bodies, I'm afraid. Let's go back up." Mary took a step forward, and a heavy weight came down on the back of her legs, pushing her down. She knelt, chest deep. Hilda took her arm to help her up. Mary tried to stand, but found that she couldn't. In the cold water, her breath came in gasps. Hilda held her under both arms.
"Oh, do get up, won't you? We're all exhausted, you know."
Mary felt down her legs with her hands. A heavy beam, it felt like metal, was pressing into the angle of her knees. Her kneecaps were pinioned to the uneven rubble of the floor. She strained against the metal. It wouldn't move at all. There was no effect except to grind her knees into the rubble, which hurt. She reached down and felt along the beam, left and right, but it stretched away further than the span of her arms. A rescuer splashed up and shone his torch on Mary.
"All right here?"
"I'm very sorry," she said. "I seem to be stuck."
She smiled, which was all one could do when embarrassed. The rescuer had Hilda hold the torch while he knelt beside Mary and tugged along the length of the beam.
"It's good and stuck, isn't it? Are you in pain?"
"Only when I try to move, which is silly, isn't it?"
"Well, you just stay calm, darling, while we get this sorted out."
"Thank you very much,"
said Mary. Until the man had told her to stay calm, it hadn't occurred to her that there might be reasons not to. Hilda held her hands. More rescuers came and began to duck under, bringing up a brick here and a piece of bar there, but whatever was trapping her was too heavy to shift. Mary gathered that the beam was set in concrete at both ends, and the concrete lodged under obstructions. She took in the men's nervous voices and the efforts they made not to alarm her. They became more methodical, searching underwater obstructions with their fingertips, trying to understand how to dislodge the beam. The sound of pouring water was loud in the sudden calm. Hilda undid her hair clips and fixed Mary's hair back to stop it going in her mouth.
"Be a dear and do my lipstick next,"
said Mary, her teeth chattering. Hilda said, "You're doing very well." The water was rising in the basement. Now Mary understood this, at about an inch a minute. While she had been kneeling, the water, which had been up to her sternum, had risen to the base of her throat. It poured down from the ceiling faster now that the rubble above was saturated. Some of the rescuers left, and Mary stared after them, wild-eyed, until someone told her they had gone to rig pumps.
"What can we do?"
Mary said. Hilda looked at her strangely. "This." Now Mary began to struggle. She heaved against the beam as hard as she could, not minding the pain as the metal cut into her calves. She thrashed and bucked, and when the rescuers held her arms to keep her still, she began to fight against them. Water gushed from the ceiling in torrents. When the level reached her mouth, Mary tilted her head back to keep her face clear of it. The water rose to her earlobes. Hilda squeezed her hands until she was calm again. In the wavering light of the torches, Mary saw the look in Hilda's eyes. Now she understood that the most awful thing was going to happen to her. Grief came. Its level rose. The water was over her eardrums now, muting the splashing.